Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, morning, or evening, depending upon when you're listening, everybody. Welcome to aboard for another edition of Midrats. We really appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of the podcast. And I'd like to extend an invitation for those who have planned their day enough that they can join us live. If you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the chat room. And if you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the program or a question you would like for us to address to our guest over the course of the next hour, that's the perfect place to do it. We'll be monitoring and sitting there with you during the course of the show. And if you don't already, go ahead and head on over to iTunes or Spotify, Spreaker, wherever you get your podcast, and subscribe to Midrats. That way, as you get your podcast during the day or during the week to listen, we'll be right there available for you if you don't have the luxury of joining us live on Sundays. And let's go ahead and dive into the show. And here we are for generations. A great comparative advantage the United States has enjoyed at sea is the superiority of its submarine force, especially after the end of the Cold War. We had a close challenge, and then nobody was even close. But nothing stands still. Time and technology move forward. And any attempt to blunt that advantage that potential adversaries may have, we need to make sure and stay ahead of that with new ideas and new technology. And as the challenge at sea grows, what we want to do today, specifically focus in the Western Pacific and the capabilities that the People's Republic of China is developing, is how we can maintain our comparative advantage in undersea warfare. And our guest for the full hour is returning to Midrats, Brian Clark, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute. And we're going to start our conversation today based upon a work that he did with Timothy Walton in this month at the Hudson's Center for Defense Concept and Technology titled Fighting Into the Bastions, Getting Noisier to Sustain the U.S. Undersea Advantage. And you'll find links to that on the show page. Brian, welcome back to Midrats. We're glad to have you on board.
Thanks a lot, Sal, and great to be on with you and Eagle One. Thanks a lot for having me on. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
And just to kick things off here, really simple question for me to ask because it turns it all over to you, but take for a moment and talk about the impetus for you and Timothy Walton to put together this effort, and what does the article cover?
Yes, Al. So what led us to this is about 3 or 4 years ago, there was a lot of reporting in the media, mostly the military national security press, about the undersea Great Wall that China was developing, where they were building their own version of SOSUS. They were putting in some active sonars. They were starting to try to build out some capability to be able to detect submarines and maybe respond with anti-submarine warfare capabilities. And that sort of passed, and there hasn't been much talk about it in the last few years, at least publicly. But in the meantime, the Chinese have done a lot of efforts above the water to make it even harder for our forces ashore, our forces on the surface, to be able to break in and be able to affect any situation that might arise in the South China Sea, East China Sea, Taiwan Strait. So the anti-access challenges people talk about is becoming more difficult. There's increasing numbers of longer-range missiles, both for anti-air, anti-ship, anti-ship ballistic and anti-ship cruise missiles. And the Chinese have begun fielding a larger blue water fleet that, you know, could theoretically some sea lines of communication, you know, beyond the first island chain. But they've really emphasized, you know, this ability to use their reconnaissance strike complex of shore-based missiles and air-based missiles to threaten naval forces and surface forces out to the second island chain and beyond. So that has all been happening in the last few years. It's been accelerating. And meanwhile, you know, we had this discussion about the undersea Great Wall that sort of faded from the conversation. But the increased effort that Chinese are making above the water has made it so that we've been even more dependent on submarines to be the key capability for us to be able to stop a Taiwan invasion. You know, as the area above the water gets more contested, we got to keep, you know, focusing more and more of our attention and our, you know, relying more on undersea capabilities to be able to do torpedo attacks, missile attacks, or targeting to support other people's attacks against amphibious ships that might be crossing the Taiwan Strait. So the dependence on submarines has only grown. We haven't been talking that much about the undersea capabilities that China might be fielding. And so, you know, kind of cutting to today, you know, China has continued to build out this undersea Great Wall, building out this sensor network. We had a conference up at Newport at the Naval War College a few weeks ago where some of this was discussed, you know, in an open source on classified level. I'd already written the report by then, but a lot of this information will come out in their public proceedings that have come out of that conference. So the Chinese have not been sitting still. They've been investing in continued capabilities undersea to do the sensing and the targeting of submarines. The key aspect of this that I think people don't necessarily think about is our submarines are still the quietest. They're still going to be very hard to find. But the problem is, you know, if we rely on them as our exclusive day one, hour one capability against the Chinese, that means as soon as they start shooting, they're going to be beset upon by all, you know, China's anti-submarine warfare forces because they'll be detected by these undersea sensor networks. So the fact that we're depending more on the undersea is going to make us more vulnerable to the fact that China will detect us as soon as we start shooting, put those submarines under threat, and force those commanders to now run around trying to avoid getting shot as opposed to carrying out the missions we're depending on them to do. And you could see how this could cause our whole war plan to sort of crash to a halt because we lose that hour one capability until, you know, those guys can get back in and regain their stealth. So that this conundrum, this challenge of, well, how do we still use the undersea as that day one, hour one capability against the Chinese in an environment where they're going to likely detect our submarines as soon as they start doing anything useful? And that's what led us to come up with, you know, this idea for the report to say, well, this seems like the same challenge that bombers had, you know, back in World War II and into the Cold War of, you know, strike aircraft had to deal with air defenses, and they got better and better over time, and we started to field new and more sophisticated capabilities to defeat those and suppress those air defenses. So we got to do the same thing undersea now. We got to think about how do we suppress and defeat undersea defenses in the same way that we did that did against air defenses, and then what does that look like? And so the study is intended to sort of explore how do we create the team of capabilities that a submarine is going to depend on to be able to get into the bastions, get into these areas where they have to be able to execute attacks to support U.S. war plans, and allow them to survive and be effective. You know, so it's not just a matter of staying alive, but you also got to be able to do your job. And I think it's hard to do your job if you're getting shot at all the time. So the study is intended to explain how the Navy could flush out this team, field a team for undersea warfare that's, you know, very different than the kind of lone wolf, you know, con ops we have today. And in a lot of ways, by borrowing these tactics from air warfare, it's going to force us to think, you know, less about the silent service being, you know, alone, unafraid, and quiet, and more like, you know, a team of platforms and unmanned systems that are really actually being a lot noisier than they used to be, because that's how you hide in the 21st century, is not by being quiet, but actually by having a lot more noise in the water, a lot more things to worry about. That's what's happening above the water. We're just going to see that, I think, that same trend playing out below the water.
I must confess that when I first read the title, Getting Noisier, I went to my experience in the world of limited experience rule of ASW, and all we could hear was a lot of shrimp clicking and stuff. And I thought, you know, maybe they're just going to take pistol shrimp and drop them into the sensor networks to distract the Chinese system. But let's talk a little bit about the tools that could possibly be used to defeat the China's blue, what do they call it, Blue Ocean Information Network.
Yeah.
Talk about the, I mean, you've got UUVs, unmanned undersea vessels. You've got large ones, small ones, all kinds of good stuff. So kind of talk about how you're looking at that.
Yeah. So the, you know, the basic approach, if you think about a lot of the ways that we do suppression and defeat of enemy air defenses, that they're going to apply here. So to be able to, you know, get into an area, you know, submarines can still usually, you know, get into an area without being detected. I mean, that's not an issue. But what you're seeing is, so one challenge will be active sonars. So China's starting to field active sonars, and I talk about some of the publicly, you know, discussed ones in the report, but there's other ones that are obviously probably not publicly discussed. But they've got a variety of active sonars on the seafloor in places like the Philippine Sea, South China Sea. Well, our submarines are designed to deal mostly with passive sonars, and so we reduce the amount of noise we generate, and we try to do some things to reduce our active target signature, but you know, not as much as you know we would if we were facing only active sonars. So our submarines could be detected by these active sonars, some of which are operating at you know low frequencies that run for you know that because they're low frequency they can detect things out you know 100 miles away potentially. So that's a pretty big cone that you'll have to avoid. So either you avoid those areas and hope for the best. Or you could do some things like air warfare or like, you know, air power people do, which is you can put decoys out there or jammers. So if you're up and against the air defense radar, you're going to try to do standoff jamming. So you're going to maybe do, you know, jamming to try to reduce, you know, the return that the radar will get from the thing it's trying to detect, in this case, the submarine. So you could do acoustic jamming to send, you know, noise back down the pipe of the active sonar and overwhelm it and force and you know reduce the signature or the return it's getting from the submarine. Or you could do you know DIRFM jamming, you know digital radio frequency memory, but in this case acoustic, where you're going to send a signal back that's going to emulate a target but at a different location doing a different speed and course than your actual submarine. There's things you can do against those active sonars using jamming and decoy operations that are very similar in you know, signal processing to what we do in the air. And then once the submarines get in, you know, if they avoid the active sonars and they generally will not be detected by passive sonars, then the question is, well, how you present yourself or how you prepare yourself to be able to do operations? Are I got to start launching torpedoes? Are I got to start launching missiles, which are going to be detectable at some point? So then you get into the idea of, well, I need to you know, probably start to confuse the Chinese as to where I actually am when I'm leading up to those operations. So the idea of putting decoys out in the water, relatively you know large numbers of them, you know, it may not need to be thousands, but certainly if you could put dozens or hundreds out there, that would be helpful. Those acoustic decoys could be built more or less like the ones that we use for target practice today, you know, the EMAT. And those can be on small UUVs. Small UUVs could also do the active sonar jamming that I talked about earlier. And then you could also have periscope decoys, you know, that will emulate a mast or a periscope at the top of the water, and those could be small UUVs as well. And if you're China, they don't have a robust ASW search capability in their ships and submarines. So basically, if they get a submarine detection, they're going to have to jump on it, right? So every submarine detection, they're going to have to respond to. Well, if you put enough decoys in the water, now they're responding to a lot of POSUB detections, and they're going to have to either pair back, you know, and triage their responses, or they're going to burn out their forces just trying to respond to every potential submarine detection. And if you do that as you're preparing to start your operation, you know, that's a way to start, you know, preparing them for being able to rapidly attack you once you start actually conducting engagements with missiles or torpedoes. So getting to that point of being able to launch, then one of the challenges is, okay, where are these small UUVs coming from? Because you might need a lot of them. There could be you know, hundreds of them that are needed in the water to support, you know, this you know, offensive movement into the bastions. So the submarine can carry them. You know, in theory, they can carry you know, quite a few on board, you know, especially if they're in the form factor the size of a countermeasure. So the internal countermeasures on the submarine are 3 inches in diameter. You carry, you know, pretty large inventory of those. You could launch those as UUVs. They might need to be a little bit larger, though, to get the power and the endurance you need for these decoy operations, in which case they might actually be taking too much room on the submarine, and that would affect your weapons capacity because you'd have to stick them in the torpedo room. So just like in the air warfare case, you're going to have other platforms, you know, do this deployment. So airplanes, aircraft, you know, like unmanned aircraft or you know, P-8s, et cetera, could drop these small UUVs in the water. You could also have surface vessels drop these small UUVs in the water, and they can drive out to where they need to go. Or you could have larger UUVs do it. So the extra large UUV that the Navy is developing, the Orca, its first job is going to be mine laying, which is probably the best thing to start with. It's pretty simple. You go out and drop the mines and you come home. It's not as sophisticated as some of the other ideas. But it could also drop these small UUVs in the water. You know, because that's just as simple an operation. And then the small UUVs go off and have to do their operation. And then you know, once the submarine gets into, you know, close to where it needs to go, I think the other big challenge that they're going to run into and that the Navy's concerned about is mines. You know, if you're China, mines are a great way to keep U.S. submarines from going into places you don't want them to go, because our submarines generally don't have very strong mine clearing capabilities. Obviously, they can't clear mines, but they have minimal mine search capabilities, and those mine search capabilities are active, so they require the submarine to reveal itself in the course of looking for mines, which is obviously counterproductive. So the idea would be submarines would need to use an onboard UUV to go out and look for mines and basically map out a queue route, a clear route, so it can get from where it is to where it needs to be through a potential minefield. And I guess the Navy's new medium UUV, the Razorback they're developing, which is torpedo tube launch and torpedo tube recover, that vehicle could be used for this mine warfare, mine search mission, so you can map out a queue route and get the submarine where it needs to be, despite, you know, Chinese efforts to put in mines. And then, the one other, class of vehicle that the Navy has been developing but is sort of on the shelf right now is the large diameter UUV, which got canceled last year or truncated or stopped or whatever, paused, the Snakehead. And the reason most, mainly is that the Snakehead was to be deployed by submarines from their dry deck shelter. So Virginia-class submarines or Ohio-class submarines, SSGNs, would deploy this out of the dry deck shelter that SEALs normally use. And that, it was problematic because SEALs obviously need to use those dry deck shelters, and we can't have them all taken up doing large diameter UUV deployment. And also it's a cumbersome operation for the submarine to do, and it really hinders its ability to do any other missions while it's deploying or while it's carrying that thing around. So the LDEV really kind of faltered on that, on the deployment scheme. But I would argue, and we found the report, and our analysis has shown that the LDEV is sort of the one vehicle the Navy has that has the depth capability, so it can go deep enough, it can go for a long enough mission to make it useful in the IPOE, or the Intelligence Preparation of the Environment mission. Because one thing we found as we went through and did some math on this is, if we're going to do these decoy operations and we're going to, you know, try to, you know, avoid, you know, where submarines might be more easily detected, we got to map that out in advance. The same way that we use EP3s or rivet joint aircraft to map out air defenses before we do a strike operation. We're going to do the same thing undersea to be able to understand where the sensors are and where the networks are and where we might be able to either decoy or jam them, or we may have to go in and physically interrupt them, damage them. But you got to map that all out, and the only vehicle that we have that's really got that capability would be this large diameter UUV. And the deploying that would then be something you probably have to do from an amphibious ship or something with a well deck, which is perfectly viable in peacetime. You know, in wartime, this, you would probably not be mapping anything out because you've already either learned what's happening or don't know what's happening. But that's kind of what we say is the, you know, the kind of the main thread. So one thing this led us to do is to identify for offensive undersea warfare, you know, what the reference missions would be for each of these classes of UUVs, because one of the challenges the Navy's had in unmanned vehicles is really settling on what's the base case need for each of these classes of vehicles to let them to drive the requirements and drive the development. And so the small UV, it ends up being this decoy and jamming mission. And then for the medium, it ends up being this mine warfare mission. And then for the large, it ends up being this intelligence preparation of the environment mission. And then for the extra large, it ends up being mining on our mines, offensive mining from the U.S., or deployment of these small UAVs, which is about the same mission in a lot of ways. So that's kind of the general scheme that we came up with to address the fact that submarines are going to be challenged just getting into this area, and then they're certainly going to be challenged to stay in it. And I can talk a little bit more about how I would expect the Chinese to respond and why we have to do some of these things.
Yeah, I'll probably mention a couple of things I'll loop back to later. But for those that haven't read it yet, again, everybody here, we have a link on the show page if you want to go ahead and pull it up. But there's you've already touched on a lot of it. But a lot of the discussion here, I really like y'all, first of all, addressed a big issue, is there's a lot of things that we want our submarines to be able to do, but we only have so many to do them. So what are those important but lesser included missions that we might be able to instead have unmanned systems do that? And figure number 17 on page 43 of the document, when I saw that, it pulled together a few things, because I think y'all made a really good argument on these achievable things. But I read it right after I talked to an old friend of mine who is really focused on the 2027-2030 part of the decade of concern, people like to euphemistically call it. And the hard fact is if whatever we're going to go to war with in 2030, it's what's in our present palm right now. Anything else that comes later this decade, 2035, 2040, in any operationally useful numbers. And you outlined well starting in 2020 and really going to 25, 26, there is this procurement trough. And so, show me what you value by what you spend your money on. So we have elected some decisions, you alluded to some decisions made in 2022 that extended that trough down the timeline a year or two, exacerbating a procurement issue when it comes to unmanned systems. And I know on the aviation side of the house, my friend Jerry Hendricks and I, we still lament it was over a decade ago that we had the capability to really do some lessons on unmanned systems, but NAVAIR decided to demur a decade plus. So we lost that opportunity. So if you could, for a while, talk about that procurement trough and what the opportunity cost is for us being able to learn how to be able to do some of these additional missions with unmanned systems as opposed to asking a $3 billion Virginia class to go do it.
Right. Yeah, good point, Sal. So so to start with on the idea of taking pressure off of subs, right now, we have about 50, just short of 50 submarines in theory. As you've noted in your blog, a third of those are in deep maintenance of some kind. Some of them are parked permanently while they're waiting for a long overhaul like Boise. Others are broken because of our own mistakes like the Connecticut. We've got, 18 or so submarines that are in some kind of, overhaul or waiting for an overhaul. And so you've got a limited capacity. So we're, if we're depending upon having, a half dozen or more submarines available to support a Western Pacific contingency, we can't have them off doing a bunch of other missions that either consume their service life or are going to take them away from being ready to respond or training to be ready to respond. So some missions that they do today that I would probably be ones that you'd want to shift to another platform are survey missions or ISR missions, where some of these UEVs that are in the certainly within the wheelhouse or technological wheelhouse today could do some of those missions. I mean, we do bottom surveys with UEVs. We do you know, some of these ISR missions could be done with UUVs, and we just not haven't availed ourselves of that. Now, part of this will involve a little bit of just maturing these platforms a little bit to get to where they can do these relatively simple missions. But medium UUVs already do, you know, some of these missions today. It's just they don't do them in place of submarines. The other big thing is in ASW. You know, so we tend to, you know, think of submarines as being the best tool to use against other submarines, and that's sort of a holdover from the Cold War when the Soviets had really quiet submarines, and we often had to search for them in places where it wasn't practical to send our own, you know, frigates and maritime patrol aircraft to get to. Times have changed. Obviously the submarines that we're looking for, some of them are still very quiet, like the Russians still have some very quiet submarines, and the Chinese have some new Yuan-class AIP submarines that are pretty quiet. There's new sensors out there. So we have much improved active sonobuoys. The MAX sonobuoys are fantastic. They do a really good job. We now have, you know, low-frequency active sonars, so variable depth sonars that can be deployed that they're putting on the frigate. The Constellation-class frigate will carry it. European navies have these ubiquitously. So every frigate in the European NATO's fleet in Europe has a variable depth sonar that's low frequency active. And those systems could be put onto, you know, unmanned vehicles. So we could see, transition of a lot of those ASW missions away from submarines and really bear down on the idea that we should be doing the first part of any, you know, ASW kill chain should be almost exclusively done with unmanned systems, whether it's a deployed system like a sonar system that sits on the seafloor and looks up, or it's SOSIS that's already installed, or it's a sonobuoy that gets deployed by PA or even an MQ-9. You know, that sonobuoy is an unmanned system. Or you could have, you know, unmanned surface vehicles towing towed arrays or variable depth sonars. And these are all available today. I mean, these are all systems that could be integrated today and have been invested in a lot of cases. So that could really relieve a lot of the pressure off the submarine fleet. Because the challenge, as you noted, is the fastest way to get more submarine capacity for the U.S. would be to get more of these boats out of overhaul. So that's job one. Let's figure out how to get these overhauls done and get these boats back into service. Because accelerating construction, is something we've done and continue to try to do, but you're probably not squeezing any more blood out of that turnip. I mean, at this point, we're getting, you know, 1 in 1.3 submarines per year because we've transitioned to the Block 5 larger Virginia class. We're also trying to build Columbia. We've really, you know, stressed the system as much as we can stress it. So we may get back to 2 submarines per year at the most, and that's not going to really change things until the 2030s. You know, those submarines are not arriving and being useful until then. So what we really need to do is focus on the fleet of today. Well, let's free up submarines from these other missions, surveys, and ASW. Let's get the ones out of overhaul that are already in overhaul. And then the way to, you know, kind of free up the submarines is going to be let's get more of these unmanned systems out there, because in the next 5 years, you can get a lot of unmanned systems out there. You know, that technology is pretty mature. The systems are relatively easy to build. You can scale that. That's one thing you can scale pretty quickly is unmanned systems. And as we see in the report, when you go off and actually do the research and figure out, well, how many of these are we buying? We had this huge trough that started a couple of years ago in terms of procurement. And it's mostly because, you know, the Navy's got these, you know, whatever, 4 classes of UUVs, and they sort of dawdled on all of them in terms of coming up with, you know, what's the mission it's supposed to do, what's the problem it's supposed to solve, and then what does that mean in terms of requirements, and let's go build them. And even if it's not the right answer, you know, the first one you build is not the final answer, go build the first one and deploy it and begin using it. But because they, you know, they couldn't settle on a reference mission, they couldn't settle on the requirements. You know, they tended to, you know, go for a very ambitious set of requirements, particularly with like Orca. That forces you into a long R&D cycle, and you're sort of dawdling in the R&D and requirement cycle. Meanwhile, you know, you've got, you know, manufacturers that are looking for orders because they're ready to build, and you've got submarines that are sitting, you know, on the block somewhere. So we've missed this opportunity to take advantage of, you know, UUV production capacity to build out the UUV fleet to make up for shortfalls that we're just going to experience because of other issues in the submarine force. But yeah, this block, as it currently looks, it's going to progress all the way through 24, and it's anticipated then we're going to get our act together and start buying MUUV and small UUV in quantity. But you know, the thing, you know, we by canceling LUUV, we slowed that process down, and there's a bunch of, you know, subsystem manufacturers that are sitting on their hands now. By going down to one manufacturer for the medium UUV, we've, you know, eliminated some capacity we could have had there. And then small UUV is being developed based on an existing commercial vehicle, but the Navy is still going to dawdle coming up with requirements for it instead of simply taking the commercial vehicle and then making that a military system. So this, you know, kind of dilly-dallying while we, you know, try to polish the cannonball in terms of requirements is really holding us up in terms of fielding a viable unmanned fleet, because the technology is there. It's the procurement process. It's not serving us well.
One of the other issues that I think you touched on in the paper is the communications problem. And since we're insistent on having man in the loop on most of these systems, can you kind of talk about the possibilities of capabilities we might have to develop in order to make sure that whatever we're doing, we're able to talk to the units that are doing it?
Yeah, great point, Eaglein. So we go through, you know, in detail the kind of C3 architecture you might use or the C3 capabilities you might use to support operations with these systems. So the first thing we try to do is develop CONOPs that were not dependent upon continuous communications with the UUVs. You know, so we envision that the submarine would still be the thing that is launching weapons, unless it's a mine being deployed by a UUV where the mine has already had built into it, you know, the automated targeting that we're comfortable with. But otherwise, it's the submarine, you know, leading the kill chain, or somebody else, somebody external, but a manned platform. And that gets around this problem that how are you going to maintain real-time comms with a thing that's got a weapon on it so that you can have a person be responsible for the weapons launch? And, you know, it's all about accountability. I think, you know, sometimes we lose, not we don't, but some people in the public discussion about this, you know, talk about the capabilities of unmanned systems to make decisions and do automated target recognition and all that, and how capable they are. But the problem is it's accountability. So who's accountable for that decision? And I know, talking to our current 4-star commanders, they want a person to be accountable for that decision, even if they're doing it based on information provided completely by some, you know, automated program or computer-aided program. That's why we felt it was important for the submarine to still be the thing that's launching weapons in these kill chains. That means the unmanned systems then are doing support functions where you don't need to maintain continuous comms with them. So they can be out there doing this decoy mission, you know, which could be pre-programmed. It could have been done, you know, based on a certain time delay, or more likely, you'd command initiate and then you'd command stop when they need to stop the decoy operation, or you could direct them in terms of, you know, making some changes to their mission plan. So decoys and jamming, you know, would largely be able to happen like that. The mine search, kind of the mine warfare mission, when you're doing it with a torpedo tube launch and recovery UUV, you're going to be tethered back to the submarine with a fiber optic cable, so you've got comms there, which is how the submarine will know where the mines are, the potential mines are. So that command and control is relatively straightforward. And then when it comes to like LDUUV doing IPOE-type missions where it's surveying to find where the sensors and networks are, that's going to be one of those things where it goes out and does it and then comes back and gives you, you know, feedback either during the operations. It'll come up periodically and do that, or it'll hold that all and give it back to you when it returns to comms depth. And then the XLUUV doing mine warfare is largely kind of a pre-programmed thing, so you're going to tell it where to go and where to deploy the mines, and that's going to be, you know, done without having to further communicate with it. Now, these vehicles will all need to have a way to kind of get back in touch with you to say something bad happened, or I ran into something, or so I detected something that I didn't expect out here. And we talk about some comm schemes, in there for being able to do that. But go ahead, I think you had a question. So to finish that thought, you know, in terms of the submarine, then the key is, how does the submarine, you know, communicate back with everybody? Because if it's the kill chain, if it's the, you know, guy with the weapon, they're going to depend on sensor information from either their UUVs or from, you know, some external queuing. So how do you get that information to the submarine? How does the submarine communicate back whether it's ready to launch or if it has problems with its, you know, engagements. And so we talk about kind of three big ways to do that. So you'll want, you know, two are the kind of the tried and true methods. So you got, you know, floating buoys of various kinds, you know, that allow you to receive comms. And if you, you know, some buoys can allow you to send comms because it's a data bubble. So it goes to the surface, transmits, and then it scuttles itself. You know, or you can use a towed buoy to be able to do that. It's just, you know, a little more vulnerable because you're doing it from something that's clear, that's still attached to you. So you're still in the location where the transmission's happening. And then we also talk about, you know, laser comms, you know, being an option that's sort of now reaching maturity. There's been, you know, back in the day, we talked a lot about using lasers to be able to pass through the air-water interface. And that technology is reaching the point where it's actually viable to do that now. So there's been, you know, there's been decades of experiments on this. So we're kind of at the point where those systems should be reaching maturity, and we might be able to actually use a laser to be able to communicate between a submarine and things above the water or on the surface of the water. And then the last thing is acoustic comms. Obviously, we, you know, used that in the past. The challenge here is, so normally what we would do is, you know, a submarine can communicate with a ship that's got a receiver on the hull of the ship. So you're able to transmit acoustic communications to the surface ship. The surface ship can then relay them or just hold them. And that works great, but in these situations, you're unlikely to have a friendly surface ship around. So we didn't talk about that being one of our main communication schemes, but in areas that are not nearly as contested, obviously that'd be one of our standbys, is this acoustic to RF interface you get from a surface ship.
Yeah, I'm glad you all spent time talking about that, because one of the great overlaps of both a critical capability and a critical vulnerability is the electromagnetic spectrum, whether you're right. trying to use it or you're trying to stop somebody else from using it. It's, you know, one of those things that you just got to, whether it's communication or navigation, that there's a whole spectrum of how much it can interfere with either a specific operation or even over an entire operational error, and technology can help you a lot with that. But there's one area of challenge, and it's a graphic I've seen before, but I was so excited to see it in your report that I'm actually using it as a foundation for my for a little article I'm posting tomorrow, and that has to do with the topographical map between Taiwan and the mainland, into the north, into the southwest of Taiwan, because there's a lot of really important people in decision making who, when they look at an ocean, they see water. They don't look right. at the fact that they're what's underneath. When you're talking about using again, incredibly huge $3 billion Virginia class submarine, or God forbid, one of our SSGNs based on the Ohio in certain waters, or trying to have an acoustic homing torpedo in certain water shapes, it's a huge issue for operations and planning. And talk a little bit about how you can see addressing that. You're not going to do anything about geography. That potential barrier, which also can be an opportunity, using unmanned systems.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we included that because, you know, obviously it's not all water is equal. You know, so if you look at the Taiwan Strait, many parts of it are too shallow to really operate a submarine in without risking getting detected on the surface, right? So there's chunks of it that are just so shallow that you'd have to be, if you're going to be safe, broached to drive through, you know, and obviously in wartime you'd try to, you know, do it underwater, but you'd be hard pressed to do that without risking getting, you know, running up against something. So there's some pretty narrow, you know, channels. If you're coming in from the south, you can see on the map there's a kind of a narrow channel next to Taiwan where you can sneak through from the top. You know, there's a wider area, you know, that you can maybe get into the Taiwan Strait through, but it's not that deep. And so by operating at these shallower depths, you expose yourself to, obviously, if you broach or, if you are, depending on the water conditions, you could sometimes even be seen. But what it does do, it makes it easier from the Chinese perspective, where they could put mines to block off these entry points. It also means they can concentrate their sensors and their ASW forces that they do have against those areas. So if you want to get into the Taiwan Strait, you're going to have to, probably fight through, a pretty concerted effort on the part of the Chinese to prevent you from getting in there. It does provide opportunities in, terms of unmanned systems because, our submarines may want to stay outside of these areas, get as close as you can using the mine-clearing UUVs to be able to stand by and maybe launch, some long-range torpedoes and hit some things. These constrained waters also give you a lot of opportunities for unmanned systems to go in and be able to identify, target, ships that are crossing and provide that information back to the submarine. So the submarine could even launch some, medium UUVs out there to do sensing and identify where these ships are coming. Because they're also, in a lot of ways, constrained by these channels because some of them are so shallow that you wouldn't want to take amphibious forces across it because they might run aground before you get to the beach. That constrains their freedom of movement as well, and that's something we could take advantage of, putting sensors out there. UUVs or unmanned systems could send that information back to the submarine, and then the submarine could engage them with missiles if the range, is longer than what a torpedo can hit. So those are opportunities that, the U.S. could take advantage of. And then the question is, well, how do you get the unmanned systems in there? Some of them might come from the submarine. Others might have to get, dropped by airplanes. You could use, this is where you could see unmanned aircraft, that are more expendable, like an MQ-9, being used in this context. Even if it gets shot down, it's still, it can get its job done and come home, or not come home and serve the country. So I think there's opportunities there that, we shouldn't consider this geography to be strictly a liability. There's ways that we could exploit it by taking advantage of the fact that China is going to have to face the same constraints we do.
Another thing is on defense,
the First Island Chain also presents a series of constraints to China's ability to get its own submarines out. So we can use our unmanned systems to monitor those areas as well. So sorry, Eagle One, go ahead.
Well, sorry. I was looking at the use of LPDs as motherships for both UUVs and USVs. Can you kind of talk about that? Why that platform? And have we ever tried that using any of these unmanned assets?
Yeah. So with the LDUV in particular, the deployment mechanism was the thing that kept the Navy from being able to really continue the testing program that would have allowed the program to continue. That was one of the big hindrances. So coming up with a different deployment scheme was essential to being able to have that that platform out there, which we saw as being kind of the key capability for doing the intelligence preparation part of the CONOPS. So we looked around, who's actually looked at how to do this? And it turns out that, the amphibious community has already done some of these tests where they've deployed UUVs out of the back and USVs out the back of LPDs or LSDs. So both have been used. And the idea there is, obviously you got a lot of capacity, so you can carry a lot of them. And so when you get to not so much the LDUV, which is probably expensive and you don't have a huge number of them, but if you want to launch a large number of medium or small UUVs that are going to go out and do a decoy mission or stand by to do a decoy mission or a jamming mission, that's probably the platform you'd want to use to most efficiently get them out there. Depending on obviously where we are in the conflict, if it's early, the LPD could drive in and just drive out. It's more defendable than than a civilian ship would be, clearly. If you need to get something in faster or deeper, then you might go with an unmanned aircraft, that'll deploy these UUVs. And then risk getting shot down along the way. But the LPD was really attractive because, one, it gives you this capacity. And two, it's available. They operate out there pretty routinely. And if you want to do it clandestinely, they could do it without raising attention because they're out there operating, doing exercises on a routine basis already. So it's not like it would draw any undue attention to itself. The other thing is, if we are in a situation where we're kind of in the, lead up to some kind of confrontation over Taiwan, you'd have Marine Littoral Regiments moving around inside the first island chain. Most of their gear would already be ashore, though, so there'd be space on the LPD to carry additional unmanned systems. And it would be operating in this area, so it'd be able to deploy some of these systems into choke points along the first island chain. So these UUVs could begin start positioning themselves in preparation for future operations where they get tasked to begin decoying or jamming. And then the last thing is we did a naval aviation study last year that we talked about. And in that naval aviation study, we identified that, we thought the LPD was actually a good platform to deploy some of these runway independent UAVs like the Valkyrie, like the UTAP 22. So some of these platforms that the Skyborg program and that the Air Force has been looking at that don't require a runway, that use rocket assisted launch or just launch themselves off of a deck. Those LPDs are very useful for that because it takes that pressure off of the aircraft carrier and gets those vehicles that are pretty long range into the fight. So we saw the LPD as being really useful in terms of it being able to do this unmanned system deployment platform.
We're a dog-friendly program, so it's good to see that we have other members of the Clark family joining in the conversation.
Exactly.
Right. I'm really glad we bounced into that because that's I think it's figure 18 or so in the document. It's a great diagram of the LPD-17's class and really all, quote, amphibious, unquote, ships, their flexibility, whether – we're talking about, and we've talked about this before on MIDRATS, is I think that the Navy and its Marine Corps friends would kind of have a marketing issue with our, again, amphibious, unquote, ship. They're really multi-use vehicles from humanitarian assistance to disaster response all the way up to major combat. And they are a, here is space insert, which, one of the reasons of the two LCS variants, the independent,
right,
the LCS-2 class, there's a lot of square footage there that you can put things in and do things with it, whatever the future decides you need, you have some capability there. But you also mentioned in the article about other ways that we can not just deploy, but maintain, refuel, and rearm unmanned systems at sea, included the Navajo-class tugs, the salvage ships that we have coming up, and also some of our the next-generation logistics ships. And all of those in 2023 are USNS ships, whereas especially
right,
your fleet tugs used to be USS. Our salvage ships were USS. And I know we have Lee and a couple of our buddies there who really know
right,
this well in the chat room, that USNS does have lots of advantages at peace, but in a transition to war in the immediate period after the war, as you transition and ramp up, that also brings with us some wartime limitations. I wonder if you had a chance to talk to anybody about if we're going to find utility in having these ships, having this additional mission set, that we need to perhaps look back at the decision that had us go from USS to USNS to maybe moving a few back to USS and the advantages that will bring with it.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. So Tim and I talked about that, and we agreed that one of the things we'll have to look at is transitioning some of these ships, but mainly because they're going to have other jobs to do, right? So in peacetime, you could see them being used, you could see LPDs and these USNS support ships being employed to be launching unmanned vehicles to support survey operations, even some kind of information operations type actions where I'd want to put decoys and jammers out there in peacetime to sort of start habituating the Chinese to certain CONOPs that we may or may not use in wartime. So you could see these vessels being used in peacetime to, you know, kind of keep the unmanned fleet, you know, at sea, and as well as supporting it and, you know, refueling and repairing. But then when you get into wartime, our thought was, well, most of these vehicles or these vessels are going to need to be supporting actual salvage and repair operations and towing operations. So they probably wouldn't be available to support UUVs once that picked up. But we would see, like, the EPFs, you know, maybe get pulled into service to help support UUVs, and certainly the LPDs might get pulled in to support, you know, either UUV refueling, recharging, repair. And I think, you know, that gets into the same problem, though, is, you know, our EPFs, our USNS ships, you know, they're likely to, you know, be put into some kind of wartime service, and the Navy's going to have to think about, for all these classes of ships, what's the contingency that allows us to continue using them in a contested environment, you know, because even outside the first island chain, you know, that we're talking about here, that's going to be a very contested area in a war with China. Yeah, you may not be getting, you know, shot at nearly as much as inside the first island chain, but it's still going to be very difficult. And so I think, you know, we got to start thinking about what's our plan? You know, either we need to transition them now, or we need to have a mechanism by which we're going to transition these ships over to USS. And the time to do it is probably not in the breach. And then, you know, the last thing I would say is that this is a part of the argument that we are going to make, and that we sort of implied with this report, is these ships are relatively inexpensive, you know, and they get bought on the edges of the shipbuilding plan. So, you know, as we saw Congress the Navy added a subtender or accelerated a subtender this last year in the budget. A lot of times Congress will add these ships in additionally, you know, give the Navy an extra one. Because they're cheap enough to where you can sort of plug them in, you know, where there's some additional money for shipbuilding available. And this would be an argument for why you'd want to do that, is because I need the capacity to be able to sustain an unmanned fleet that I might find is, you know, essential, you know, to keep our submarines, you know, in the fight. And then also, you know, take over some of the missions the submarines can't be expected to do, because if we've got a limited number of them, they got to focus on those higher, you know, the higher purpose that they have in these wartime environments. So to me, that's another argument for why we need to be buying these ships in volume, and why, you know, you'd never want to necessarily stop buying a logistics ship or a support ship until you absolutely, you know, feel like you've maxed out your capacity, because you can always use them. And this is one of the applications.
Let's talk a little bit about the proposed SSNX and what you see the need for its design to be. You've got some interesting proposals on horizontally launched stuff and things like that.
Right. Yeah, so you know, the Virginia class Block 5, which is the current block, and then the Block 6, which will come after it, are going to carry the Virginia payload module. Most of them will, which gives you a lot of vertical launch capacity, which I think, you know, the Navy is realizing is, you know, limited or decreasing utility, right? Because one of the problems we're going to have in wartime is if I want to do a bunch of missile launches from submarines, it's going to make them detectable, and do we want to optimize the ship for that vertical capacity when its utility in wartime is going to be decreasing as our opponents get better anti-submarine warfare capabilities. You know, the Navy's already having to think about where do we actually deploy Block 5 SSNs in the conflict with China, because I don't necessarily want them that close, because they're going to be more easily counterattacked with, you know, counter-battery fire, essentially. You know, so I could put them farther out and take advantage of the range of these weapons. So the question is, well, if this is more of a standoff, you know, weapons capacity, you know, that kind of like I do with the SSGNs, I don't necessarily want my entire fleet to be focused on my submarine fleet, to be focused on vertical capacity. And we found, as we see in the study, that horizontal capacity to deploy UUVs is much more valuable, because those UUVs are going to be what helps the submarine to be able to get into the places where it's effective. And it's going to need the horizontal capacity for torpedoes, because that's about the one, you know, capability that we've got that's really very hard to defend against, right? We know from having to do torpedo defense that it's extremely difficult to counter a torpedo once it's, you know, got a hold on you. So torpedoes are still a very effective weapon. But you got to be able to get in close enough to use them, which means you need UUVs to be able to start creating the deception and the countermeasure campaign that, you know, prevents you from being detected, you know, even after you've launched. So that horizontal capacity ends up being essential for both weapons and for these countermeasures. And then the last thing I'd say is one thing we found in the study, which we talk about in there, is, you know, to one way of mitigating the vulnerability of submarines to being detected when they launch weapons is to do essentially delayed launches. So you deploy a weapon, it's in a capsule, it hangs around and you leave, and then at some time delay or on an acoustic signal, the canister launches the weapon, whether it's a missile that's floating on the surface or it's a torpedo that's being launched out of the canister that was floating, you know, neutrally buoyant in the water column. So that that's something the Navy is going to have to do, is think more and more about how to use these encapsulated weapons. And if you're going to use an encapsulated weapon, well, then horizontal capacity is as good as vertical capacity, because all you need to do is get the weapon out, and either it flows to the surface if it's a missile, or it stays in the water if it's a torpedo. So the vertical capacity is less essential, you know, if you're looking at using encapsulated weapons.
Well, hopefully if they design it, they'll do a better job than they did with the torpedo-launched TLAMs. From my TLAM days, you make sure and have your backup and ready spare if the primary mission is coming out of the tube.
Right.
In a lot of different conversations, when it comes to trying to figure out what China is doing and why they're doing it, it quickly becomes apparent the Chinese, they're good at studying military history. They get their lessons well, and you can see, okay, they've obviously studied X, that's why they're doing Y. And y'all did a nice job in bringing out something I haven't seen shown well before, like y'all did here, is there are some significant lessons that the People's Republic of China can take from the U.S. and allied battle of the Atlantic against U-boats. But switching the sides, we're the submarine force and they're the defending force. Outline some of those bold-faced items you think definitely apply to today that were learned in the Battle of the Atlantic.
Yeah, so the one thing we found, we did a study a couple of years ago for DARPA where they wanted us to look at historical battle network competitions and use real data, you know, to kind of draw some insights as opposed to historical anecdote. So in this study, we found, you know, the data shows that in the Battle of the Atlantic, you know, the shipping losses went down even though submarines were still out there. So late in the war, or in the middle of the war on, so 43 and on, shipping losses went down to practically zero in the Battle of the Atlantic. But there were still more submarines out there, 20, 30, 40 submarines on patrol. There were more submarines than early in the war when, you know, shipping losses were huge. And the question is, well, why is that? What's happening here? Well, the problem for the U-boats was our ASW capacity had grown. And so what our ASW forces were doing were just forcing the submarines to move away because they wanted to avoid getting shot. And because the ASW forces could range a little bit farther away from the convoys, the submarines had to stay far enough away where they really couldn't get a good shot on the convoy, and then the convoy made its way by before the submarine was able to catch back up. So submarines were being suppressed, but not actually getting killed. And we, even though lots of submarines were lost during the Battle of the Atlantic, what you found is, you know, late in the war, they were just sort of marginalized as opposed to being an effective contributor to the German Axis part of the fight. The Chinese could take a similar approach and say, all I need to do is suppress and marginalize the submarine. I don't actually need to kill it. So if you're a submarine and you've been counter-detected, normally you'd want to, you know, leave and try to regain your stealth. But let's say you want to stay because you got a, you know, mission to do. Well, once you start getting shot at, you can't necessarily stand and fight like a surface ship might, you know, where you've got air defenses and stuff that you could use to shoot back at weapons that are coming at you. You don't have a lot of counter torpedo defenses, if any, on a submarine. So you start getting shot at with torpedoes, you have to leave and evade or hope for the best and hope that nobody hits you. So it wouldn't be hard for the Chinese to simply start dropping weapons on every potential submarine contact in an effort to force the submarines to evade, and either they get detected because they're now running around at high speed, or they've been taken out of the fight because you're not able to do your job if you're running around evading torpedoes all day. And so you've been suppressed. You know, so the submarines are effectively out of the fight, and the Chinese didn't have to mount a big ASW campaign. Now, one of the ways you avoid that is you put a lot of decoys in the water, you put a lot of, you know, alternative contacts in the water, and eventually the Chinese get to the point where they can't launch weapons at every potential submarine. They're forced to pick and choose, and, you know, try to make it as hard as possible for them to choose the right target. And that's kind of the scheme that, you know, we're trying to set up is create that confusion on the sensing and sense-making side so that we can allow the submarines to get in there and be able to do their job. The other thing, though, is when you look at, you know, SSNX design or even modifications to the Virginia class, you'd want to put more self-defenses on them so that submarines could, in theory, stand and fight. They start getting shot at. Maybe you can take out the first couple of torpedoes, or at least the commander feels confident remaining in the area even after they've been counter-detected, and minimizes that suppression, you know, that the Chinese might be able to execute.
Well, I'm going back to my pistol shrimp noisemakers to help solve the problem. You've been a great as we've taken up an hour of your time, but before we let you go, what you're working on and what can we look forward to seeing from you, and where can people find it?
Yeah, they can find all of our stuff on the Hudson website, so at hudson.org. Oh, and they set up a Twitter account for me, so there's a Twitter account at Clark Defense that you can look at that I think all of our stuff's posted on. And then what we're working on right now is we are finishing up a study for the Navy on unmanned system development that we're getting ready to release next month. So it'll be out in July.
Perfect. Well, as always, y'all produce quality content, and we look forward to seeing it. And I really do appreciate you joining us today, Brian.
It was great to be here, Sal. Great to be here, Eagle One. Thanks for taking the time and having me on.
Again, thanks a lot for being here.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrets. Until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
The strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.